Mr. Chair, I move.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. I'll call the Senate Rules Committee to order.
Are you through?
I move, Mr. Chair, I move to waive the appearance and recommend the confirmation of the appointment of Carol Suzuki to the Commission on Asian Affairs.
Senator Courtney moves to waive the appearance and recommend the confirmation of the appointment of Carol Suzuki to the Commission on Asian Affairs. Any discussion?
This is your birthday.
Objection. Happy birthday.
Yes, sir, buddy.
That's, hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move to waive the appearance and recommend the confirmation appointment of Daniel Glode to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission.
Senator Courtney moves to waive the appearance and recommend the confirmation of the appointment of Daniel Glode to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. Discussion, objection, hearing none, so ordered.
Chair, I move to waive the appearance and recommend the confirmation in block of the appointment of Melissa Grant and the reappointments of Kenneth Johnson and Linda Latshaw to the Oregon Board of Dentistry.
Latshaw?
Well, that's what I say. You can mess, you can do what you want.
Senator Courtney moves to waive the appearance and recommend confirmation in block of the appointment of Melissa Grant and the reappointments of Kenneth Johnson, Linda Latshaw to the Oregon Board of Dentistry. Discussion, objection, hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move to waive the appearance and recommend the confirmation of the appointment of Christopher Heffernan to the State Board of Forestry.
Senator Courtney moves to waive the appearance and recommend the confirmation of the appointment of Christopher Heffernan to the State Board of Forestry. Discussion, objection.
What?
Do we have an objection?
Jason, what are you?
No, I want to.
He's here to.
You're sure?
He is here.
Who is
here?
He's right there.
He's got the files and the whole thing.
Make him stand up.
Stand up. Sit down.
Basketball coach.
Basketball coach.
Where's the coach? Yeah. Where's the coach?
North Tyler.
That's real people's place.
Yeah.
You don't even know where it is. Don't you act like you know where it is. You've never even been out there.
So ordered.
Yeah, I'm going to waive the appearance. I recommend a confirmation appointment of Edwin Golbe to the Government Standards and Practices Commission.
Senator Courtney, you're tearing up my paper. I might need these things, you know. Moves to waive the appearance and recommend a confirmation of the appointment of Edwin Golubay to the Government Standards and Practices Commission. Is there any discussion, objection, hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move to waive the appearance and recommend the confirmation in block of the appointments of Lynn Cameron, Estelle Dietz, Michael Goldhammer, and Genevieve. Graham. To the Home Care Commission.
Right after this meeting.
Huh?
Senator Courtney moves to waive the appearance and recommend the confirmation in block of the appointments of Lynn Cameron, Estelle Dietz, Michael Goldhammer, and Genevieve Graham to the Home Care Commission. Discussion, objection, hearing none. Senator Menace.
I just want to comment that Estelle Dietz was my opponent in 1987. Position in my district, and he's quite a gentleman, by the way. Gave me a good run for the money.
Well, okay, so noted.
Very nice man.
Very nice
man. I just want to say something kind about a Democrat.
Okay, that's good. We appreciate that. Any other discussion, objection, hearing none? So
Mr. Chair, I move away the appearance and recommend a confirmation appointment of Edward Mowry to the Oregon Board of Investigators.
Oh. Senator Courtney moves away the appearance and recommend the confirmation of the appointment of Edward Mowry to the Oregon Board of Investigators. Discussion, objection, hearing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move away the appearance and recommend the confirmation appointment of Sheridan Thuringer, the Board of Medical Examiners.
Senator Courtney moves away the appearance and recommend the confirmation of the appointment of Sheridan Thuringer.
I did that.
I did that. I know you did that to the Board of Medical Examiners. Oh, discussion, objection, hearing none. So ordered.
I can pronounce. Mr. Chair, I move away the appearance and recommend a confirmation appointment of Todd Thorn.
Todd Thorn.
To the Oregon Labor Commission.
Let me see which Thorn is that. Which one?
It is.
Is that Dean Thorn?
Mm-hmm.
They're everywhere.
Is that the son? They're everywhere. Senator Courtney moves to waive the appearance and recommend the confirmation of the appointment of Todd Thorne to the Oregon Racing Commission. Discussion, objection, none so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move to waive the appearance and recommend the confirmation appointment, reappointment of Elizabeth Herchenko as Director of the Department of Revenue. You have to look the name similar.
Thank you, Mr. Courtney. Senator Courtney moves to waive the appearance and recommend the confirmation of the reappointment of Elizabeth Herchenko as the Director of Department of Revenue.
Shouldn't we...
Commissioner, isn't he coming up here pretty quick?
I thought we... I'm surprised we're not talking to her, but... Okay.
Oh, what?
Any other discussion? You want some more money? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. That it?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Atkinson.
Could I respectfully request to carry the appointment of the State Board of Forestry?
We can do that.
Thank you.
We can do that.
Why does he want to do that?
And we'll do the rest in block. Yeah.
Why does he want to do that?
But North Powder, that's kind of his
North Powder, that's right, because he's a basketball player.
Yeah, but he doesn't represent North Powder.
Well, that, we will close the executive appointments and open up the...
Redistricting then.
He may be when we get finished with this thing.
He may be.
He's got Powder, too.
Open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 620, is it?
Is this?
He may be everywhere.
He's a young...
I hear you. We got you having in Northern California, buddy.
Oh, God. Might as well. Senator Beyer, do we have a...
You ever heard of weed?
That one.
No.
We got weed in your district.
Nothing new.
What's going on here, Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 15, representing portions of Marion, Clackamas, Yamhill, and Lynn counties. I was so happy to see Senator Courtney here in fine form. I thought he was only like that in judiciary. I'm glad to see he doesn't reserve it only for that committee. So the rest of you can share that I get with the rest of we get to in judiciary. Before you today is Senate Bill 620, which, as drafted, was a very good bill, but I decided to make it a better bill. So I would like to speak to the dash one.
You've been involved in this, Mr. Chair.
I know nothing.
The dash one amendment,
yeah, but what about
besides the replacing the entire bill, currently... You guys make it hard to testify on the side, you know that?
He said it. That's funny. That's funny.
Currently, it was brought to my attention one day, not too long ago, by three constituent calls on the same day with people who used to have contracts in business with the state of Oregon on for certain projects, and they have been shut out of the process of bidding or receiving contracts because other agencies are now doing that work for agency-to-agency transfers of duties rather than what used to go out to private industry for potential work. So what I have attempted to do with these amendments is to make it so that if agencies are going to be in the job of bidding and to do work for other agencies or for other public bodies, so we can get a true cost reflection in those bids. What the dash one amendments will do will lower or put a limitation on of $25,000 so that any contract or project of in excess of that would have to be gone to the bidding process. It also says, the dash one amendments say, that if an agency of the state wishes to bid on one of these public contracts, they shall be required to include all costs associated with the bid, including the operating expenses of the state agency, the cost of the retirement benefits provided to the employees of the state agency, and other costs associated with public contract that would be included in bids by contractors from the private sector. The intent here is so that we don't have agencies of the state going to another agency of the state and say, well, I've got a computer over here that we're not quite up to capacity on that computer, so we can do it for just the cost of the man hours for your project or something like that. The intent is to get a true cost, agency cost, so that if they are then competing against private industry bids, the bids are apples to apples type thing, not just the cost of a half-time employee and a little bit of extra computer time, but all costs associated with that bid. That is, in a nutshell, what the draft one amendments do. On page 8 of the amendments, in section 4, it reads, the amendments to ORS 279.015, 279.027, and 279.322 by sections 1, 2, 3 of this 2001 Act first apply to public contracts entered into on or after the effective date. After looking at that, I think that probably should be changed and to say advertise, so that we applied to public contracts advertised on or after the effective date for the public act, to make it clear that it's anything that's happening in the future and not just contracts being entered into, but when things come up in the future. So that, in a nutshell, is the Dash 1 amendments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. Another questions, comments? Anybody? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Senator. It's hard to read this because of the language, the way it is. Is this intended to apply only to state agencies?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, my intent was to state agencies. If state agencies are either offering the contract or state agencies are bidding on a contract, either one, and that would be the intent, and I hope and I believe that's what the language does.
Is that what it says, Cindy? Yeah, we got a big head nod. For the audience, we have a head nod. Does that get you, Senator Beyer?
Is this going to interfere in any way with contracts with the federal government?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe if state agencies are trying to get contracts to do jobs for the federal government, they would have to include in those jobs, in those bids for the jobs, all costs associated with them.
Contracts isn't synonymous with grants.
I would have to defer to...
For the audience, we got a head nod from...
We had a nod or shake, Mr. Chair?
Yes, shake, sorry.
Thank you for getting me out.
Cindy Hunt, Legislative Council's office. Let's see, Senator Lee Beyer, Mr. Chair, I think your question was whether or not this would affect contracts with the federal government. Currently, there is an exemption from competitive bidding for any contracts between one public contracting agency and another public agency or the federal government. The amendments, the Dash 1 amendments, affects that in that if it's a contract between a state agency and any other entity, and if the contract is more than $25,000, they need to competitively bid that. And so the way it is currently, those contracts may have been with the federal government and would not necessarily have to be competitively bid. But then your second question was about grants. Mm-hmm. And some grants, I think it would depend on the grant as far as if this would affect it or not, because some grants from the federal government, they're just giving money. It's not necessarily the federal government providing a service.
So, Mr. Chair, so Cindy, this only applies to state agencies and bidding for work.
Yes. Senator Beyer, Mr. Chair, state agencies that have, it applies in two instances. State agencies that have a project that they want completed, okay, currently they can, if they enter into an agreement with another agency or the federal government, they don't have to competitively bid that. Under this, if it's over $25,000, they need to go through competitive bid processes. Okay, that's the first place that it applies. The second place is if it...
Excuse me just a second. Okay. Today's rule, Cindy, they don't have to competitively bid at all, or it's over 75? This is my SMS here.
I'm sorry.
Are we just lowering a threshold, or are we establishing a threshold?
Let me see here. Right now, I mean, under the statute, there's an exemption if the contract's made with any other public agency or the federal government. So that doesn't necessarily have a threshold.
I guess Craig has the NOAR.
Agency. And I'm going to defer to who's out there,
okay.
Some DAS.
Okay, well.
Because he knows the OARs much better than I do.
Okay, we can keep on going and answer Senator Byers' question.
Okay. But the other place is that if a public agency other than a state agency wants to do a contract that they normally would go to a state agency, now that's also exempted from competitive bidding under this.
The only ones that I could think of, I had one of the utilities that raised the question
mm-hmm.
whether it applied to them and their purchase of mm-hmm. power, and I don't think that it does, but that was an issue that was raised because it says contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And the only ones that stand out in my mind that I'm familiar with is that ODOT and some of the counties have entered into contracts where they trade work.
Mm-hmm.
Where they'll actually, and the one that stands out in my mind that I've heard, I don't know about personally, but I understand is Jackson County, mm-hmm. they traded where ODOT was doing, or Jackson County was actually doing the work for ODOT, so they weren't duplicating each other. And apparently, would this then apply to that and say they couldn't do that, they'd have to bid it out?
Senator Beyer, Mr. Chair, yeah, if it's between ODOT and a county, now, yes, because ODOT is a state agency.
Is that current law?
Mm-hmm. Under the bill.
Under the bill.
Okay. Under the bill.
Those cooperative arrangements would have to be put out to bid.
Put out to bid, and then the county could bid on that, but also a private party, potentially.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that's, I think, getting out to the exact intent of this bill, is that in the last two sessions while I've been here, we have seemed to strive to make quote-unquote government more efficient by allowing them to work together and cooperate more. But what we have done in the process is we have given them the competitive advantage over jobs that used to be done by private industry. And so the intent of this is to make it that, not prohibit governments working together, but when that happens, to get true costs. And so that we can see if it's more efficient for the two government agencies to work together, mm-hmm. when you figure in all these costs, then let's do that. But if it's not, let's let private industry do it.
Yes, Chair. Mm-hmm. Senator, do you have some examples? You mentioned that there are two or three. Can you kind of share those with us? Not necessarily the names of the businesses, but the nature of it.
Well, there was a
Buyer Tree Farm was one that can remember.
There are those Christmas.
Yeah.
Actually, there was two instances in computer work where the agencies used to put some computer applications out to private bid, and currently ODOT is now doing those jobs for the other agencies. That was two examples, and one, unfortunately, this doesn't get to, and I'm still trying to figure out how we can do that, but it's with the prison system, and we've had two issues with because of ballot measure 17 requiring prisoners to work, that we now have the prison industry is going into the nursery business because they've determined that farming isn't profitable, which any farmer could have told them that 40 years ago, but they just figured that out. It took them that long, and so now they thought, well, we'll try nursery for it. Maybe that will be profitable. So we've got the state prison going into the nursery business now, and we're going to go into the, not kind of humorously, they were talking about Christmas trees also, but they decided that Christmas trees wasn't a profit in those. unfortunately, this bill doesn't get to the prison issue because that is a totally different can of worms with ballot measure or with the constitutional
17.
Issue out there, ballot measure 17, and we're still trying to figure out what we can, how to go after that one. But this is designed to go after the other issues where agencies are out competing.
Okay. We've got several people signed up, so we'll get to the bottom of this before we
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you. Dugan, why don't you come to get started?
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the Department of Administrative Services, Transportation, Purchasing, and Print Services Division. This bill basically does two things. It eliminates the current exemption under statute that permits state agencies to enter into contracts with the federal government and other public agencies, and it would require any time a state agency were to bid on a contract with either the federal government or with another public agency, for that state agency to include in its bid all its cost of operation, would include the contribution to its employees' retirement, and it would also require it to include any costs that a private bidder bidding on that particular bid would have to include in their bid to cover their costs. This affects contracts that are over $25,000, which are intergovernmental agreements. The Department of Administrative Services at this time takes no position on this, but we have a couple of concerns. One of them are the resource implications of this bill, and the second is how this might work. On the resource side of it, there are over 1,551 intergovernmental agreements. Those are agreements over $25,000 between state agencies and other public agencies, could be the federal government, could be counties, that some work is being done either by the county for the state or by the state for the county, in which over $25,000 is involved in consideration. Now, this is based on a reporting system that captured this information for the last calendar year, and this was the number of contracts that were executed during that calendar year. Presumably, some of these contracts will carry over, but this is the best data we could get in the time we had to take a look at what the potential impacts of this would be. So based on that, assuming that a number of these are personal services contracts for which requests for proposals would have to be done, and are over $1 million, those would come to the Department of Administrative Services because it's beyond the agency's delegations. So we would put those out for formal competitive request for proposal, or some portion of them would be invitations to bids, and we would put them out for formal competitive bid. The law, as the amendment as written, would require us to treat those exactly the same as we do a private sector bid. So we go through the whole posting process, the protest process, the legal sufficiency review on the solicitation document, and we've estimated that given these numbers and very conservative amount of time dedicated to each one of them, assuming that they're relatively straightforward and simple, and some of them probably, many of them are, some of them wouldn't be though, we see at least four additional positions that we would need to have if we were to bid each and every one of these that we think would come our way as a result of this change in the law. The other concern we have about the bill is it raises some questions associated with the practicality of the state adding into its bid the cost factors that go into a private competitor's bid. As I read the proposed amendment, it tells us that a state agency must include all of the costs associated with this particular bid that a private contractor would include in their bid. So that could include certainly their plant costs, their facilities costs, their lease costs, their property tax costs, employment costs, employee bonus costs, any number of things that they would calculate into that bid. That's problematic from our point of view to administer, because the public agency is not going to have any way of knowing what a given cost will be in a private sector's bid if they're not privy to what that bid is, and in a bid scenario they wouldn't be. So I think the way this is written, that creates a bit of a problem. It would take some rules and some clarification for us to understand how we were going to administer that, so that before a public agency prepared to bid, they understood what was a cost that could be included in their bid and what was one that didn't need to be included in the bid. How much a private contractor pays in property tax is going to vary from private contractor to private contractor. And since the state doesn't pay property tax, how much of that would they need to include in their bid to balance that out? So that would take some additional guidance. Of these contracts, or these intergovernmental agreements, the 1,551, many of these contracts are executed with the federal government or other counties because they're the only ones that can provide the service, or because this service simply only made sense to deliver through a county or the federal government or the state providing it to either of those entities. So I think you'll hear testimony from other agencies that go into some of the details of what those contracts actually consist of. But my sense is it's going to be impractical to actually run each and every one of those through a formal competitive process each and every time. While there may be some that certainly compete with the private sector, I suspect a good number of these simply don't.
Mr. Chair. So my question, we don't competitively bid now?
Mr. Chairman, the way the statute reads now, and this is common with most state procurement statutes, is they do not have a competitive bid requirement for government-to-government contracts. So a contract or an agreement with the federal government between the state government where money exchanges, there's consideration, and there's performance, there's reliance, there are all the elements of a contract, is allowed to be entered into without a competitive bidding process. And the same thing with political subdivisions. So that's fairly typical, and our current statute has no requirement for those political subdivisions in the state or for the federal government in the state to go through any kind of a competitive process.
Well, how do we know we're getting the best value for the taxpayer dollar if we don't have a little competition?
Yeah, I think what happens is that for many of these, the agency looks at what traditionally makes sense to do, and if the only provider is a county to do that service, or the only provider is the federal government, they've entered into these contracts through negotiation for years and years. But I think if they're doing construction or other things that are typically provided by the private sector, I think oftentimes they simply make that decision. It's never thought to do it through another public agency. But I think those are questions that have to be asked of each of those public agencies. Mr. Chairman, those don't come our way right now to put out competitive bid for. We record them on a database so we can give you the information about how many intergovernmental agreements are out there, but we simply don't see them. Those operational decisions are typically made at the agency level, and the statute has always permitted them to enter into agreements with other governments without a competitive process.
You made another statement that I found fascinating. You don't want to do this because it would be a lot of paperwork. Why would you require the private sector when they bid to do all this paperwork? Why would the public sector be required to do the same thing?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't make myself very clear on that, but what I was saying in terms of the resource implication here is that right now those contracts are being established by the agencies without going through a competitive bid process. Competitive bid process takes additional time and resources. And so if they come in at those levels over $75,000, they would come to us and we would put out a bid, or if over $1 million, we'd put out a request for proposal. And that's simply what the law would require. That would take some additional resources. Does that answer your question, or am I missing your point, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Petty, the term that I'm having some problem around is the terminology on line 7, that's all public contracts. And I guess I'm trying to think through this and see what's missing there. Construction items are easy, but would this apply then? The state does a number of contracts, and I'm thinking of counties now, where we contract for health services, mental health services, law enforcement, not law enforcement so much as corrections. Would this then require all those to be bid?
As I read this amendment, it would require those to be bid because it becomes a public contract. If the public agency is expending money or involved in it as one party to a contract, there is performance, there is consideration, there's service, it becomes a public contract.
Would it extend farther than that? I'm thinking in terms of, for example, in the Economic Development Department, there are allocated amounts that are contracted to regional strategy boards to perform economic development services in the various regions of the state. Would it apply to that?
I'm not, Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I'm not directly familiar with that, but it sounds like it would apply in that there's a service being received by the state agency, contracts, and there's consideration for that payment, then it would apply because there is a contract written around that.
Let me step to the father's one. Would it apply to the school formula, the funding that we give to the K-12 system? Would we contract with them for the grant amount? Or is that a grant? I'm trying to find out where's the distinction between a contract and a grant. Most of the ones I've seen are the language is an intergovernmental agreement is what it says.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I think the bill, if the amendment, if passed, would begin to raise some of those issues. There has simply not been a conflict in the area of grants and contracts because of the intergovernmental agreement. I think one of the definitional differences is a contract has a requirement for performance on the part of the parties and consideration, and a grant, at least in theory, doesn't have the same level of performance, but there is money changing hands. It's simply not been an issue because it's not subject to a competitive process, but many of those grants may now be contracts.
Yeah. Is there a legal distinction there someplace between a grant that's written as an intergovernmental agreement and a contract that's written as an intergovernmental agreement? I'm just trying to reach back to my old business law classes definition of a contract.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byers, that's probably a better question for counsel. I would take a stab at it to say that
she's hiding back there.
Typically, if it is a grant, then there's not the same obligation of performance and payment that there is under a contract.
There's still a lot of conditions and performance standards usually.
Cindy Hunt, Legislative Counsel's Office again. Senator Beyer, Mr. Chair, you're correct. Some of the grants, the state's simply giving money and there's nothing in return. I was thinking of the state school fund when you asked that, which I'm intimately involved with, I guess, at this point. And I don't think it would apply, but I think Dugan's right in that it raises issues around it. I mean, to that particular grant, because the Department of Ed is giving money, and I don't think they're entering into an agreement with the districts necessarily.
Sure?
But it's.
I thought they had to sign.
But it does raise an issue. There are other grants, though. I know, for example, the Department of Ed gives, where the school districts agree to do. Like expend the money on a certain program.
How about, Cindy, get off the basic grant.
Right.
It's federal money that flows through where they give it, then there's performance criteria. It's usually obligations that you'll do things in this way, and it's contractually obligated. And if you don't, you have to pay the money back kind of thing. Is that, I'm trying to draw the distinctions there.
Right. You've asked some difficult questions because, I'm serious.
You need to make a difference,
because I'm trying to think of just because, I think getting back to some of the grants, there are agreements being written, and I mean, in public contracting law, there is a definition of a public contract. However, it's pretty broad. So the question is, would some of these come in under that definition? I think the answer is yes. It would be on a case-by-case basis, though. Mm. Could the amendments be altered to exempt some of that? Yes. So there you go.
Dean?
Yes, in a minute.
If I'm understanding the objective of the amendment, Senator Beyer is not here to respond, but it seems to me that what he's attempting to do is place the state on a level playing field for comparative purposes where there is service provided by the state that could be provided by another entity. And Senator Beyer may be right. There may be the language of the bill that kind of raises questions about whether this, that, or the other thing is included, but I don't really think that's the intent or the purpose of the bill, and I'm speaking for Senator our buyer. And it'd be nice to have him here to talk about that. But that's what I think this thing is attempting to do, is at least do an apples-to-apples comparison to the extent that it's possible and practicable, so that it goes to the public interest. You know, is it in the state's interest, in public, to find places where you can supplant existing government function that can be done by competently and all those kind of things by someone else and competitively bid for those kind of things. I think that's what it's trying to do.
I agree.
Correct.
But I think my concern is he's drawn the net too big.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I agree. And so I think I want to get back to kind of the underlying assumptions and the intent of the bill and kind of the question of whether or not that's a good public policy or not. So I think we can talk about what the bill does and how many personnel you might need to administer and so on and so forth. But I want to get back to that central question as to whether or not it is in the state's interest to allow this kind of thing to happen in certain circumstances. So, I mean, you might say, well, gee, it's going to create a whole host of new questions and problems for us to not have public agencies supply this information. And I would say, well, why would you not? What's the justification for the state or any other public agency to not competitively bid? What's the overriding interest here that supersedes the interest of the public to have the access or the ability to compete?
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond to that, Senator Minnis, I think you're correct in your assumption. I would suggest that the competitive bidding in the RFP process may not be the most efficient and elegant approach to making that kind of threshold decision about what's in the best interest of the state. Some of these contracts or intergovernmental agreements may be very obvious that they should be competitively bid, and maybe there's a threshold decision that would cause you to put that into the bid basket, where others it may also be very obvious that there really isn't a private sector alternative to it, and that best interest of the state determination, probably best made by the agency, could be made without subjecting this contract to what could be a long, drawn-out process of a competitive bid or RFP, which may not serve any interest in the end to either the service provider or to the public who can't compete on that. So there may be some better policy mechanism to make that decision before you subject it to an RFP ITB process.
And, Mr. Chairman, I agree there may be. I mean, there may be some areas out there where someone who has a business is looking at a government function saying, you know what, I think I can do that job for less money at the same quality level. What I think they're asking for is access. Let me bid. And if I do bid, if there is a comparison, then it's an apples-to-apples comparison so that there's an analysis that's done to say, yes, this is the right way to go. And we get into these discussions about private prisons and corrections and on and on, and you get all of the various discussions about quality of service and cost and benefits and all that kind of thing. So at least the way I'm reading this is the attempt is to try to get apples-to-apples comparison so someone can make a good public policy decision. And I think to provide access, because our world's changing. There are probably services that are provided within state government that private entities may very well want to provide. An example of that might be collections services. I mean, for a long, long time in our history, collections were left to state agencies. And it was come to our attention that there are billions of dollars of uncollected debt, and that just happens to be there. So people are beginning to think, how can we rectify this situation? So, there are interests out there, I think, that are being generated and created that could very well do these functions, but it should be on a comparative level that's even, because I think the unions have, I think, a good argument to say, look, if you do this, you have to recognize that you're losing certain functions also. You're losing maybe control, you're losing consistency, at least have a forum to make that argument.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Doug Tindall.
Thanks, Steve.
Chair Harper, members of the committee, I'm Doug Tindall, maintenance engineer for the Department of Transportation. A lot of this testimony has already come up, so I'll make this relatively brief. The direction of the past several legislative sessions and at the recommendation of the ODOT Efficiency Committee, we've moved forward to strengthen our partnership with counties and other local and federal governments in performing highway maintenance to reduce duplication and make sure we don't have trucks passing each other going opposite directions off to do the same task. In fact, this has led to, as Senator Beyer alluded to, in Jackson County, a one-stop opportunity for the public where they don't have to know now whether it's a county road or a state highway. They can go to one location and do their business. This amendment would, as Senator Roger Beyer said, this amendment would shift our attention away from doing those partnerships and into bidding. It's just a change in direction from where we've been going. So with that impact, recognize that the impact of passing this bill is that you'll see less attention from ODOT on local government partnerships and more attention on ODOT in preparing bid documents to get the work done. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
You had a couple of examples of ODOT and computer. Any idea what he's talking about there, Doug?
Chair Harper, sorry. Not on the computer side. Can't imagine what was going on there.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Jackie? Zimmer?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jacqueline Zimmer, and I'm the director of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And I'm not sure, but I think we might be an unintended target of this particular amendment. there are 18 area agencies.
Never happened before. History of the legislature.
There are 18 area agencies on aging around the state of Oregon. Each one of them has a unique contract with the state, and a bill like this would probably cause a pretty significant disruption in our service delivery to the vulnerable seniors and people with disabilities that we serve. One of the items that I want to point out to you is that we're mandated to go out and enhance the programs and services that the state gives us money for. So we raise somewhere around $6 to $10 million in around the state that enhances the programs that we have, protective services and so on and so forth. So I think if a bill like this were to go through and somebody came in and bid on that, they wouldn't be required, because they're not an area agency on aging, to go out and enhance and raise money in their local community to enhance services. So there are some things that we provide that could be lost if something like this were to go through. So I just wanted to let you know I'm kind of thinking we probably weren't the target of this, but we'd be happy to discuss any questions you might have about our relationship to this bill.
Okay, thanks. Counties, Judge Pryor, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. And with me today is Judge Laura Pryor from Gillam County. We thank you for the opportunity to testify on the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 620. As I think you've already possibly discovered from the testimony, these amendments have very far-reaching implications. Certainly do for counties. We're concerned that the amendments to 620 would severely limit the ability of counties to continue to partner with the state of Oregon, its departments and agencies, to deliver many of the services that we are delivering today. Mrs. Zimmer talked about services to the aging, which are provided through intergovernmental agreements or contracts with the state. I've just cited in my testimony some illustrations of intergovernmental agreements that we have with the Department of Transportation, but I also have today something I just received this morning from one of the counties identifying the intergovernmental agreements in the county with state agencies in excess of $25,000. And this runs almost the total gamut of state agencies, from the Department of Human Resources for nutrition and WIC services to children and women and infants at the county level, drinking water program, alcohol and drug programs. Mr. Chair, this goes down through Department of Corrections, intergovernmental agreements that counties would have with the Department of Corrections, Children and Families Commissions. And we just feel that it would significantly disrupt the service delivery system that is in place today, where counties are the deliverers of many of the services for the state agency. We are, in many instances, the arm of state government in each of our locations. It's, as Judge MacArthur frequently says, we're kind of the Department of State Deliveries, State Service Deliveries. So we're concerned that, though I'm sure the bill was introduced to address some particular problems, that it's extremely far-reaching and has implications that were not intended. With regard to contracting for many of these services, counties, and you, Senator, know the remote nature of some of the Eastern Oregon counties, oftentimes will request bids and have no one respond, or maybe we'll have one bidder respond to the bid. And so then they have to look at other avenues to get those services provided, and oftentimes that's looking to another county or looking to, in the case of roads, the Department of Transportation to assist in delivery of that service. So we would just encourage you to give this bill serious consideration, and I've asked Judge Pryor to join me today to share with you some of the concerns that a rural county might realize if this kind of legislation were passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Laura Pryor, and I am the county judge in Gillum County. And I seem to always be coming before these committees, and some of you more often than others, talking about rural Oregon. But I think it's the nature of the beast in the fact that we have 36 counties, and they range from 500,000 people or more down to 2,000 people. So anytime you have a piece of legislation come before a legislative committee, such as your own, you're always having to view that in light of the differences across this state on the population basis. Bill has referred to a couple of things here that I think are very true. One is in the smaller counties, and if you can picture the map of the state of Oregon in your mind, with I-84 running at the north end, and everything east of Bend, north and south, south from I-84, there's a lot of the state out there in the land mass where the community is so small that there are times when you can't do a project because you can't order concrete, because concrete, they're all busy during the summer in Bend or Pendleton or Ontario or someplace. You can't get engineers because they're really busy with projects in the metropolitan area. You can't even order asphalt. So when you're doing a project, you have to aggregate not only a project that's big enough to attract people to come in and do it, but you've also got to then aggregate the funding. And many times you try to aggregate that funding across jurisdictions. Often the only service provider within an area is, and I'll restrict this to transportation,
is ODOT. We partner very well with ODOT, and many times we just can't get anything done if we don't partner with them. And that, I don't think there's any way I can express how serious that is in a lot of the state where you don't have communities that are larger than 500 people. We have to deal with the prevailing wage. For most of us, that's Bend, although our wages aren't nearly what they are in Bend. If you're depending upon whether you're doing a federal or state project, you have to deal with their engineering standards, all the bid requirements. These are all adding costs that you have to try to overcome in the aggregating of the size of the project so it's big enough and aggregating the funding. So I think that a lot of the state of Oregon, the smaller communities, have developed their system based on leveraging everything. You try to leverage more than one project, you try to leverage it across seasons, or try to aggregate it through a season. You may have a project where the state can come in and they can help you with the engineering, and then you can crush the rock for the project. So there's a lot of different ways that you try to mix and match and create the volume and the value to be able to do the project. Again, I think a lot of the difficulty with this has to do with the different sizes of the different counties, where the population bases are. And the last part of this I would like to refer to is 622. We're all out there now trying to develop these circles. For a lot of Oregon, the private sector doesn't want to come in and do it. In our three counties, we can't get the private sector to come in at all. So we're going to have to leverage the 622 money with local money. 622 money is going to come from the state. And we've got to try to figure out how to do this with partnerships. So where we can afford to do it, we certainly would like to bid. But in some cases, it's just not possible. Private sector does not want to come in. There's not enough people out there to make it worth their while to do it. So I'd like to ask you if you would consider that, please.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don Loving, Arlen Stepper.
Mr. Chair, members, also, just for the record, the City of Portland has submitted written testimony, which I will pass out to you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Don Loving. I'm the Public Affairs Director for Oregon AFSCME, which is the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We're here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 620, or I guess more properly, the amendments have been offered to become Senate Bill 620. I'd like to say that from the standpoint of an agency that represents public employees, 22,000 in this state and 1.3 nationally, that the idea behind public contracting, to our view, is to get the best deal we can get for the public for their tax dollars. And sometimes that's with the private sector, but sometimes that's by using public employees that are already in place. And in response to something that Senator Beyer mentioned early on, our council is concerned that the language in this is broad enough that it would not affect just state agencies. Now, I'm not an attorney, and I can't enumerate the whys and wherefores of that, but I just wanted to mention that she is concerned about the broadness of this language. Regardless of that fact, we are concerned that Senator Minnis was saying that this doesn't create apples to apples, that this kind of raises the bar too far the other way, that the bill would inflate what we like to euphemistically call contracting in costs with artificial costs, and would essentially preclude our members from being able to competitively bid on these projects, therefore costing taxpayers money at the other end. I think of things such as, PERS retirement costs and bonding, where we have cities that are self-insured. Those are some savings that help us save money. In my role as with AFSCME, as Public Affairs Director, I get these case studies from all over the country. I have Florida, Indianapolis, Minnesota, Chicago, of these contracting in projects where we've shown how this saves money for everyone. But the fact is, one of the ones that AFSCME likes to send out that's one of the shining examples in the country of successful contracting in is, in fact, the City of Portland Water Bureau. And I have with me here Mr. Arlen Stepper. Arlen is the immediate past president of Local 189, which is our City of Portland local. He's a longtime employee of the Portland Water Bureau, and he's just going to briefly walk you through, you know, the process of contracting in that's become a national example. And I've also brought copies for some background for you of the methodology for these kind of projects that was developed with the city back in the late 1990s. So I'm going to defer to Arlen, let him walk you through this briefly.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Arlen Stepper. I was a past president of Local 189, AFSCME, the City of Portland. We have about 1,200 employees. About in 1993, we initiated a partnership, a labor management partnership with the Water Bureau initially for about 5 years. One of the things that we were looking at, there was a lot of privatization going on in water, and we wanted to become mean, lean, and be competitive at that time. And that was where a lot of that reinventing government was coming around in a variety of things. One of the first things that we had to do was come up with a cost methodology. In government, and I'm not an accountant, you know, this is with a group of city accountants and a variety of people, developed what was called an incremental cost model. The city uses a fully allocated cost, which is includes the cost of the mayor, the cost of the administrator. Specifically, if you get into like the Water Bureau, an agency, the Water Bureau does not just provide water. It also does Endangered Species Act, and those are costs for that. It has a well field. There's costs for the well field. We have Bull Run. There's costs for Bull Run. The incremental cost was derived from a number of national models where examples that Don just gave us, Indianapolis is a huge one, where they did a lot of competitive bidding. And the incremental cost accounts for the cost of the crew, the cost of the equipment, the cost of the supervisor on there, the cost of the engineer designing the job. What it excludes is the cost of the mayor and all these various other things. This model was developed over a period of 2 years. We had two court challenges by the AGC. We won both of those. We also had it reviewed by a neutral third-party accounting firm, passed the flying colors. Also, we sent it back to a subject matter expert, Lawrence L. Martin, PhD, associate professor at Columbia University, and had it reviewed. Withstood all those tests. It was developed out of the national models that we pulled together. And so, what I see in this legislation, it does have a fatal flaw, and that is in Section 2, Subsection 3, where it talks about the basket of cost here. This is not apples to apples. This is apples to oranges. This is a fully allocated cost model, which you cannot derive the cost at for bidding, and what we called it was a make or buy decision. And the incremental cost model, and what you get these handouts, explains, went through and considered every one of the costs in an operation, whether they were a not just the ongoing capital cost, but are they a negative or a plus that adds to that project. So you run it like a business when we competitively bid. It's the things in that unit that occur cost. And one of the other thing is that we have used this to save a ton of money. We went beyond this model in the Water Bureau. We all went citywide in the City of Portland and had a labor management partnership. It was adopted by the City Council in Portland to use the incremental cost approach. So we have a variety of services that we do bid competitively. One of the other overriding factors that we always used in our model was an example, and go back to the Water Bureau. We do functions day in, day out, such as construction. We do about 20% of our construction there. 80% is bid. One of the examples that we look at that we don't bid on are jobs that come up once a year. An example is we have 160 sites. They need a specialized mower to be mowed once a year. We hire a contractor. We're not going to spend the capital or hire the personnel to do that. It would not make business sense. But if we have something within the agency that we can do for another agency and bid on it, that is routine, that's part of what we do, we bid on those. So the city does really look at you know, what is within the scope of the specialized things that government services provide, which is really important. We do things that are very specialized. Our bureaus that, and I'm not acquainted with the state agencies specifically you're talking about, but we do a variety of things, such as the Water Bureau. We do ESA. We have well fields. We have a variety of other functions do across the board, not just construction. So this model was developed specifically for weighing and going out and doing functions. We have continued to bid out a variety of functions. It's been about a 50-50 split. Example is at Bull Run, we used to have contractors come in and do brush clearing for the Forest Service. We had our people up there complaining for years that we could do it cheaper. Using the incremental cost, the cost of, you know, the equipment, the crews, everything specifically tied to it, we did it for 20% less. That wouldn't have been able to, you know, be able to ferret out those costs unless we had this incremental model. Best example I have is I participated in nationally, it's called the Ford Foundation, funded a nationwide group that it was IBEW, ASME, a variety of other unions to come together and compare what they're doing as far as labor management partnerships and bidding. Best example is down in Palm, Florida. We had a unit down there in water that they were having all their water mains done by outside contractors. It came out to $100 a foot. After they did some analysis and using the incremental approach to analyze costs, real-world accounting, they discovered that they were doing it for $52 a foot. If you don't have the right tools to ferret out those costs, then you really can't compare it. But what's proposed here in this subsection 3 is not apples to apples. I've done this for probably 8 years. We just had a group come in from Nova Scotia that wastewater and water there was being combined in a three-county area. And they came to Portland to see our methodology and how it's applied. You know, it is really not being used in a lot of places. But you know, cities that are on the cutting edge that are dealing with privatization, you know, and want to have competitive services, they use the incremental cost approach. And so this here does not get at, you know, deciding whether those services are, you know, effective or not.
Okay, great.
So in closing, Mr. Chair, if the current law isn't apples to apples and is in fact apples to oranges, our view would be this is apples to pears and we're against it.
Yeah, okay.
All right,
thanks. Jason Williams.
Chair Harper, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. On the way down here, I wasn't fast enough to catch the amendments. That's why I had submitted a testimony, and then, but throughout the testimony, I was sitting there thinking that there is something very relevant in my testimony that I wanted to bring your point to that is segues into what we're talking about. And this deals with the success that happened in Arizona. Arizona was one of the states that had the worst debt collection of any of all the 50 states, including Guam and Puerto Rico and some of the non-states. And then they went through a massive government reinvention effort and were able in a few years to suddenly become one of the better states, constantly ranking in one of the best, most improved states in terms of child support collection. Now, if you look at the last sentence of my testimony, it's kind of what I wanted to point to, and that deals with that part of the success of Arizona, this miracle that happened in Arizona, was in contracting with private collection agencies, privatizing central payment processing services, and expanded use of vendors for genetic testing to identify paternity. This was one of the neat things about what happened in Arizona, was that they had processes that they were doing themselves within the government jurisdictions, and suddenly they decided it's not working. Let's begin to contract this out, and it saved them money, and it brought in a better efficiency. And as you can see, you know, their collection had improved 141% from $52 million to $129 million. That's a lot of money. And so I just wanted to submit that example, saying that there are examples out there where opening up the bidding process, the privatization, really can net great rewards.
Okay. Thank you. Margaret Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Johnson, and I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division, and I'm here testifying in opposition to the Dash 1, the proposed Dash 1 amendments to the bill on behalf of the Department of Human Services.
Excuse me, Margaret. What I need you to do is describe the impacts of this bill. You don't take positions for or against. That's what our job is. But, okay, go ahead.
The concerns that the department has with the bill as it's current, or the amendments as they're currently written, would relate to the fact that most a substantial amount of the business of the Department of Human Services is done through agreements and contracts with counties and other governmental entities. For example, in my division, in mental health, we process over $800 million of transactions through our agreements with county mental health. And as we read these amendments, they would require that they are competitively bid. In most cases, for the programs that the department provides, they do so in this way at legislative direction. For instance, for our services, the statutes require that we assist Oregon counties and groups of counties in the establishing and financing of community mental health and developmental disabilities programs. In the context of the amendments, we believe that this would require a competitive bid process for the provision of services that are basically safety net services that are provided by private nonprofit in conjunction with local governments, and in provision of a safety net of services to people with disabilities and other needs. So we would I'd like to get those records on, or those concerns on the record.
It would impact you greatly, I understand. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else not signed up?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhardt. I'm with the League of Oregon Cities. I, too, would like to oppose this bill. I know you've heard all the testimony. I will be brief. The cities, too, work well under the intergovernmental agreements they have going, and would not want anything to stand in the way of those agreements or get hurt the working relationship they have now. So we would also like to oppose the bill.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Better run.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Tom O'Connor with Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities. The concern that we'd just like to get on the record that we hope could get cleared up, we were trying to get information from the Department of Energy. In the Energy Facilities Siting Council process, the Department of Energy contracts with other state agencies like DOGAMI and Ag and DEQ and Fish and Wildlife to perform the assessment of the project. Those are handled right now as part of the siting process. The concern, if those were to have to go to competitive bid, that would lengthen the siting process that I know you folks have been working on really hard to shorten. And I know that's an unintended consequence. I just want to hope we get that cleared up.
Actually, your buddy Senator Byers already brought that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I was trying to get the Department of Energy, and I didn't get it.
Okay. Thank you very much, everybody. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 620, and we are adjourned.
We're not adjourned.
I take that back.
LC. Mr. Chair, I move LC 4206 be introduced as a committee bill or drafted for a committee bill. Is that right?
Introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Courtney moves
LC 4206 be introduced as a committee bill. Discussion objection. Hearing none, so ordered.
Is there anything else?
Yeah, we got
these two are LC draft requests.
Chair, I remove that
Roy Hemingway letter.
Nothing's easy.
I don't know what you, where are you getting Roy Hemingway? I don't know where. I don't know what he's.
What do we have? There's some. Here you go.
I.
Senator Courtney moves Roy Hemingway letter.
Letter be, of April 3rd, 2001, be turned into a LC a draft.
Okay, objection, discussion objection, so ordered.
What else you got now?
And I got the memorial for.
I move that the Craig Allen administrative memo to our committee dated April 24, 2001, LC request be developed, be LC drafted, I guess.
Okay. Final discussion state. Objection? Ordered.
Okay. Is that it?
There we go. All okay, right. Now we're really adjourned. Thank you.